Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Bereans Bible Institute. I'm Pastor Tim Warner. We are in module number 7 on the apostolic mission. The last 11 lessons have been on the ministry of the Apostle Paul, the 12th apostle. Today will be part 12 of that section. Let's turn in our Bibles to Acts chapter 18. Last week we talked about Paul at Athens and his speech at the Areopagus, where he confronted the Greek philosophical schools, and he presented them with something that was new and foreign to their thinking, which was the message of Christ as this man who has been resurrected from the dead. And Paul preached to them the resurrection, something completely contrary to their philosophical thinking, because as followers of Plato and Aristotle and some of the other Greek philosophers, the folks at Athens had this concept that man was not just what you see. Man was not a physical living creature, you know, similar to animals, but, you know, obviously of a higher intelligence. But that man was something unique in that he had he was not really what you see. In other words, what you see is not really the man. The man is some kind of an immaterial spirit, ghost, soul, whatever you want to call it, that existed previously and has always existed and will always exist, which is why they believed in the immortality of the soul. and that a man is, that this ghost, this immaterial consciousness, is imprisoned in a body of flesh. And so flesh, the body of flesh, is the prison of a soul. That was one of Plato's famous sayings. And so the hope in the Greek philosophical worldview was eventually escaping this immaterial person inside of you, who is really you, escaping from the physical flesh and eventually ascending into heaven in some sort of a pure spirit form, right? So they envisioned that the material creation was evil, that pure spirit, the immaterial, was good, and that escaping from the material is the essence of salvation. So in that kind of philosophical thinking, we see that whether it's reward or punishment for how we have lived our lives, in that kind of a mindset, comes at the time of death, when allegedly this ghost separates from the body goes back to dust, and then this ghost has to go somewhere, either, you know, to be either in a positive direction or a negative direction, depending on this person has lived their life. And so the judgment of a person and where they go from there takes place at death. Paul's philosophy was completely different, and that is that when a person dies, they die, and that punishment or reward takes place at the resurrection. That is, the person is raised from the dead physically to be, you know, in the flesh, to stand before the judgment of God. And that's how Paul portrayed it in his speech there in chapter 17. So we see that this was something unique and unusual to the Greek mind. And of course, many or some did believe the message that Paul preached. Well, following this, Paul moves out of Athens and he goes over to Corinth. Now, Corinth is also in Greece, and it's really not very far from Athens. So it's still in the hub or center of of Greek philosophical thinking, but it's more, you know, on the outskirts of Athens. And remember, Paul is alone at this point. The rest of his team is not with him. He left Luke in Philippi, and he left Timothy and Silas back at Berea. And so he traveled alone, or at least without his team, I should say, to Athens, where he stayed for a little while, did all that, and now he travels over to Corinth, and he's still alone, as we'll see the rest of his team, or at least Timothy and Silas, will join him in Corinth. So let's pick up in Acts 18, beginning in verse 1. It says, "After these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla." And then it has in parentheses, it says, "because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to depart from Rome, and he came to them." That is, he came to Priscilla and Aquila at Corinth. "So because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they," that is Paul and Aquila, "they were tent makers." Now, this is a very interesting passage, and if you don't really understand the historical setting of what's going on here, you'll miss a lot of the richness of this passage. It says here that, first of all, that this man named Aquila was a Jew, and Paul went and stayed with him. So obviously he was not a Jew who was hostile to the message of Paul, but he was a companion for Paul, and Paul stayed in his home with he and his wife Priscilla. So we can infer from that Aquila and Priscilla both were already Christians. Even though they were Jews, they were Christians at the time that Paul met them at Corinth. And it very well may be that Paul heard that there was another Jewish Christian named Aquila at Corinth nearby, which is most likely why he left Athens and went down to Corinth there to stay with him. Now notice it also says that he was born in Pontus. Aquila was born in Pontus. Excuse me. Pontus is an area of Asia Minor, today what is today called Turkey. It would be up on the north, about the north mid section or north east perhaps part of modern Turkey, on the southern coast of the Black Sea. And this was an area where there were quite a few Jews who lived. In fact, all of Asia Minor or Turkey, there were quite a lot of Jews there, and there were a lot of synagogues and so forth in that area. And so we see that he was born in Pontus, but it says that he had recently come from Italy. Now, why was he in Italy? If he was born from Pontus, why wasn't he in Pontus? Well, we're going to read a little bit between the lines here, but I think there's enough information here to actually draw a pretty clear picture of what was going on. All right. Now, it says he had recently come from Italy, and then it tells us why. It says because Claudius, who was the emperor at the time, had commanded that all Jews depart from Rome. So obviously, Aquila and Priscilla had been in Rome for some time, and even though they were not from there. And Claudius, the emperor of Rome, made a decree that all Jews were expelled. He expelled all the Jews. And this is something that was that's well known in secular history, that Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome. Now, there's a Roman historian by the name of Suetonius, and he stated in his history of the Roman emperors, he stated that Claudius expelled all the Jews from Rome, and the date was about AD 49. And here's what he says. He says, "because they were constantly rioting at the instigation of one named Crestus." Now, Crestus is just a Roman pronunciation of the Greek Christos, which is the Greek word for Christ or the Anointed One. And so it was because of this Christos or Christus that the Jews were constantly rioting, according to the Roman historian Suetonius. And because of the constant rioting going on, the emperor in Rome, Claudius, he said, you know what, I've had enough of this trouble right under my nose. All Jews are now officially expelled from Rome. You cannot be in Rome. If you're a Jew, you have to leave Rome. Well, why were the Jews in Rome rioting? Because of this Christus or Christ. Well, we're informed that from other sources that there were at the time of at about this time of Claudius in Rome, that there were about 13 Jewish synagogues in the city of Rome. And the gospel came to Rome sometime, probably not long after the day of Pentecost. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us explicitly how the gospel came to Rome, but what happened was some people, apparently, who had been present on the day of Pentecost, when the Holy Spirit was poured out and Peter spoke in tongues, and we have Peter's sermon recorded in Acts chapter 2 and so forth. We're told in Acts 2 chapter 10 that amongst the congregation of people that heard the apostles speaking in tongues and that were present on the day of Pentecost and who were among the 3,000 Jews who believed the message and were baptized by Peter and the other apostles. Among that group, according to Acts chapter 2, verse 10, it says there were visitors from Rome. And remember, these were all Jews. All these people that were present, it says that there were devout men, Jews from every nation under heaven, who were gathered for the festival of Pentecost when this supernatural occurrence took place. So we have some Jews who were visiting Jerusalem for Pentecost from Rome. Now, it's interesting because we see here that in Acts chapter 18 that Priscilla and Aquila, or at least Aquila, was a Jew and that he had come from Rome because he had been expelled by Claudius from Rome, right? So I also want to point out something that ties in Priscilla and Aquila with the church in Rome. And that is, if you'll take your Bibles and go to Romans chapter 16. Now, the book of Romans was written sometime later after, you know, Paul was in Corinth and he stayed with Priscilla and Aquila and all that. It was written later on his third missionary journey. Paul was, we know it was on his third missionary journey because his third missionary journey ended up with him being in Rome. And the book of Romans was written prior to his arrival at Rome. So it was written at the beginning portion of Paul's third missionary journey. But in chapter 16 of Romans, Paul is sort of, you know, at the end of his epistles, he, you know, gives a closing statement. And a lot of times he has greetings to people who are special to his heart. And he says in the last chapter of Romans, he says, I commend to you Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of the church in Cenchrea, that you may receive her in the Lord in a manner worthy of the saints, and assist her in whatever business she has need of you. She was a deaconess who had been sent there to Rome. For indeed she has been a helper of many and of myself also. Now notice when he... first of all, Phoebe was not from Rome. Phoebe was sent to Rome and apparently was carrying this letter that Paul had written to the Romans. She was carrying it and delivering it to them. But when Paul addresses people from the church in Rome, the very first people he mentions are Priscilla and Aquila, the same couple that he stayed with when he was in Corinth, when the Emperor Claudius had expelled all the Jews from Rome, and so Priscilla and Aquila had to leave, and they went to Corinth, and then Paul met, met up with them in Corinth and stayed with them. So he says, listen to what he says here. He says, "Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus, who risked their own necks for my life." And this is talking about what happened back at Corinth in Acts 18. "Who risked their own necks for my life, to whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles. Likewise," now notice this, "likewise greet the church or congregation that is in their house." So Priscilla and Aquila now are, when Paul wrote the book of Romans, were back in Rome after what happened in Corinth and Paul staying there. You know, Claudius ordered that all Jews were expelled from Rome in AD 49, but when Claudius was no longer emperor and Nero became the emperor in AD 54, then that ban was lifted. And so a lot of these Jews returned back to Rome. And so when Paul wrote the book of Romans, Priscilla and Aquila were back in Rome. And the congregation was meeting in their house. So they probably had a pretty large house. Right, but if the congregation was meeting in their home, then that shows that they were of some prominence and highly regarded by the church in Rome. So, again, I said that earlier there were about 13 Jewish synagogues in the city of Rome. After Pentecost, the day of Pentecost, when there were some Jewish visitors from Rome in Jerusalem, when Peter preached his sermon and when 3,000 Jews were baptized, they all went back home again. And so the visitors from Rome would have gone back to Rome. And being Jews, being, you know, having heard the message of Christ, having received Christ, having been baptized, now they're all excited to get back to their home synagogues in the city of Rome, and there's 13 of these synagogues. So when these people went back, what happened in the city of Rome? Well, what happened anywhere the gospel went to the synagogues of the Jews? What happened? There was some who received the message. There were some who refused the message and became violent. And this is what happened. As I mentioned before, when the Roman historian Suetonius made this quote, he said that Claudius expelled all the Jews because they were constantly creating riots. And they were creating riots amongst themselves. See, that you had 13 synagogues, and you had some of them that embraced the message of Christ that was brought back to them from Jerusalem by, I believe, Priscilla and Aquila, and perhaps others that were present as well. Were some of these Jews who had brought the message of Christ back to the synagogues in Rome. Some of the synagogues embraced the message. Some did not. Those that did not were constantly creating problems and riots. And you notice that it doesn't say that, you know, the Roman historian doesn't say that the Christians were expelled from Rome. It says the Jews were expelled from Rome, but that included those Jews that became Christians, those Jews that belonged to the synagogues that embraced the gospel. So this feuding between the synagogues that embraced the gospel and the synagogues that rejected the gospel created such a disturbance for the emperor in the city of Rome that he expelled all of them, whether they were Christian Jews or opposed to Christ. He didn't care. He just expelled them all. And so this is why we find Aquila and Priscilla in Corinth at the time that Paul arrived there. So I just want you to I want you to see that this man Aquila and his wife Priscilla are very important and prominent people in the church in Rome. Now let's go to verse 6. We're back in Acts chapter 18. I'm sorry, verse 4. And excuse me. "And he," that is Paul, "reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded both Jews and Greeks." Now, you know, Paul is, it, when it says he reasoned, that's different than just preaching. You see, you can preach a message, you can stand up and declare the way it is. But when you reason, it's always a dialogue. It's always a conversation. All right? So he's reasoning, which means what Paul's doing is he's taking them he's going to the synagogue and he's going to the Old Testament scriptures and he's bringing up these prophecies about Christ and he's talking about them. And then he's talking about what happened with Jesus in Jerusalem and in Galilee, the things that Jesus did and the reports that were coming back. And he's showing them, look, here's the prophecies and look, here's Jesus and here's what happened to Jesus. And he's comparing these two things and he's reasoning with them. And they're no doubt bringing up objections and things. Well, what about this? This prophecy says this, did Jesus do that? You know, and they're, you know, kind of going back and forth in a dialogue of reason. Okay. Now, but look what happens. It says, verse 5, when Silas and Timothy had come from Macedonia, remember he had left them back in Berea, in the city of Berea, to get that church established when he went ahead to Athens and now he's gone on to Corinth. So that now Timothy and Silas arrive, two members of his team. He's not alone anymore. It says, Paul was compelled by the Spirit, by the breath of God, and he testified to the Jews that Jesus is the Christ. That is, he is making a hard declaration. It's no longer now reasoning. He's now declaring it to be so. All right? And it's a shift in the manner in which Paul is engaging his fellow Jews at the synagogue. All right? It's a shift from, you know, well, hey, let's look at the prophets and maybe this, you know, maybe this is fulfilled here, or maybe this is, you know, and trying to tie that in with Jesus. But now he has shifted gears and now he's just declaring it so. And why would he do that? You know, when you're having a discussion with somebody, a theological discussion with somebody, there's give and take and all that, as long as it's, you know, a two-way street. But when one side then begins to just declare that they're right and you're wrong, sometimes the conversation just breaks down. And one of the reasons why Paul did that was, no doubt, it obviously it says the Spirit impressed him to do that. And it's no doubt because Paul was reasoning and providing reason after reason after reason, but they were not responding. See, they were resisting and opposing sound reasoning from the scriptures. And so the Spirit compelled Paul to just declare it, that Jesus is the Christ. You have to accept it or else, basically. Verse 6. But when they opposed him and blasphemed, you can see now where their heart was. He shook his garments and said to them, your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles. Now, Paul has made this kind of a statement before when at the synagogue he was rejected and his message was completely rejected. He would say, all right, I'm done with you. I'm going to the Gentiles. And again, that doesn't mean that Paul was done with all Jews from now on. It meant I'm done with you Jews in this synagogue in this city. Right? I'm finished with you. I brought you the message. You reject it. Now, from now on, while I'm in this city, my message is going to be geared towards the Gentiles. And that was his typical MO. All right? All right, let's go on to verse 7. And he departed from there and entered the house of a certain man named Justus, one who worshiped God, whose house was next door to the synagogue. Now, this you have to understand Luke's terminology. He uses terminology like someone who worships God. Whenever he uses that, you may remember back when we were talking about Lydia in Philippi, that she was it Lydia that was a worshiper of God? I forget. I might be mistaken on that. But anyway, it uses this term of one who worships God as meaning one who worships the God of Israel. And it's usually talking about a somebody who's not born a Jew, but who has converted, a Gentile who has converted to the God of Israel, all right? And so this would be what we would call a proselyte. Anyway, this man named Justus, and Justus, by the way, is a Roman name. So he was no doubt a Gentile who had converted to Judaism, and now he has become a Christian. It says his house was next door to the synagogue. Talk about rubbing salt in the wound, right? The synagogue throws him out, and so what does he do? There's a guy who lives next door. He accepts the gospel. Paul goes into his house, and they start, you know, they start a small congregation next door to the synagogue. You know, that's got to rub them the wrong way at the synagogue. But you think that's bad? Look at the next verse. Then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. That is, Gentiles. So now what we have is Paul leaves the synagogue and they throw him out, basically. But the ruler of the synagogue, that is the head guy, the guy who's like, you know, he'd be like the pastor of a church. You know, if the whole church threw the apostle Paul out, but the pastor goes with him. He goes with him. He goes with Paul and he goes next door. He apparently abandoned his own synagogue when they revolted against the message. Anyway, so now we have Crispus, the ex-ruler of the synagogue, if you want to say, and a man named Justus, who's a Roman, who's believed. We've got these two converts. Now, obviously, the ruler of the synagogue was a Jew. No question about that, right? Now, what's interesting here is this guy Crispus shows up again in Corinthians. When, you know, Paul wrote, much later, Paul wrote letters to this church that he established here in Acts chapter 18 in Corinth. He wrote 1 Corinthians to them later, and then after that he wrote 2 Corinthians as well. And Paul mentions this man, Crispus, who was the former ruler of the synagogue in Corinth. I want to show you that. Go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And let's look at verse 14. He says, I thank God. By the way, in the context, Paul is in Corinth. He's talking about how that several factions had come about, and the church was being split by these different factions. This is, of course, much later. That were going on in Corinth. And one of the reasons was it was common in a Greek city like this, it was common for religion to be segregated into factions. Because, you know, remember, we had the Greek philosophers, right? And there were some who claimed to be followers of Aristotle, some who claimed to be followers of, of Plato, some were Epicureans, some were, you know, they had all their different factions in Greek philosophy as well. And so the Corinthians, you know, they're used to this kind of different schools of thought that kind of compete with each other. Well, they started doing the same thing in the church after, you know, they were, after Paul left and some time went by, they started, you know, their thinking was still very much along the lines of what they were, excuse me, what they were used to in their Greek philosophical schools. And so Paul had to write this letter to correct some of the problems that were going on in Corinth much later. And so he bemoans the fact that, like verse 12, he says, I say this, that each of you says, I am of Paul, or I am of Apollos, or I am of Cephas, or I am of Christ. And they're dividing up, you know, the church into people who follow these different apostles or whatever. Verse 14, he says, I thank God that I baptized none of you. That is, Paul personally didn't baptize any of the Corinthians except Crispus and Gaius, lest anyone, excuse me, lest anyone should say that I had baptized in my own name. Yes, I also baptized the household of Stephanus. Besides, I do not know whether I baptized any other. Now, what Paul did when he was in Corinth or when he went to any of these places, he made it a practice not to personally be the guy who did the baptizing. Now, you remember he did, there were lots of baptisms. Remember in Philippi, the Lydia and her family were baptized. And then the Philippian jailer and his family were baptized. But Paul was not the one doing the baptizing. He had Silas, or he had Timothy, or he had Luke doing the baptizing. He preached, he was the primary speaker, but he had his team members doing the baptizing. And one of the reasons why he did that was, he said there in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, he didn't want people to think that he was baptizing people in his own name. See, and this was the Greeks and their philosophical way of thinking. They wanted you to join their particular philosophical school, and they had certain initiation rites that they pronounced, you know, or had people involved in to become a, you know, a Platonist or, you know, an Epicurean or one of these other schools of thought. They each had their own little rituals that they went through, and so the leader of that philosophical school at that time would be the guy who would take you through the rituals so that you would become part of their little club. Well, Paul didn't want to be seen as somebody who was establishing a following himself. He didn't want to be seen as the guy who was to be followed. He didn't come to preach his doctrine. See, Paul didn't come to preach some new theory, some new philosophy that he had figured out on his own, like all the other Greek philosophers did. Paul came preaching the message that was given to him to preach, which was the message of Jesus Christ. And so because Paul didn't want a following himself personally, he wanted to point people to Christ, to follow Christ. And so this is why he says in 1 Corinthians 1 that when people were baptized, when he preached, that he didn't do it himself. He had his team members do the baptizing. But he said, he noted that there were a few exceptions. And in Corinth, apparently the first one that Paul himself baptized, at least the first one he named that he baptized, was this guy named Crispus. Crispus, again, according to Acts chapter 18, verse 8, was the ruler of the synagogue. So see, if you look at who was the most prominent convert to Christianity in Corinth, who was the most prominent one, it would be Crispus, because he was the head of the synagogue, the very synagogue that threw Paul out, but yet he went out with Paul and believed and was baptized by Paul. And the first church in Corinth was established with the leader, the ex-leader of the synagogue. So no doubt Crispus became sort of the head elder. And we're just speculating with regard to that. But because of his experience and because of his sacrifice, it seems almost certain. And because Paul mentions him first as the very one of the very few that he baptized while he was there, no doubt Crispus became the leader, or one of the few leaders in the church in Corinth. And remember, when Paul went around ordaining elders and so forth, and establishing the government of the various churches, he normally would choose people who had a very strong background in the Old Testament scriptures, which would be Jews, right? Because almost all the churches that Paul established were established from splits from the synagogues. And so there would be a core of Jews, and then more Gentiles would come in. But you don't put somebody in charge of the church to be a head teacher in the church that was raised in paganism and hasn't had a good solid background in the Jewish scriptures. And so the elders in the early churches that Paul established were mostly Jews. Okay? Anyway, let's go to verse 9. Well, verse 8. Then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his household, and many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. Now the Lord spoke to Paul in the night by a vision, quote, "Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not keep silent." You know, apparently, you know, when we look, if you look at Christ's command to Paul here, telling him not to be afraid and to speak boldly, and when you go back and compare that to verse 4, where it said Paul was reasoning in the synagogue, which is a more subdued and a laid-back way of presenting the message of Christ, and not until Silas and Timothy showed up did he get bold and proclaim that Jesus is the Christ. Well, what Jesus is telling Paul here is, look, I don't want you to hold back. I don't want you to be timid at all in the message. I want you to boldly proclaim the message of the gospel. All right, be bold. In other words, Paul, you're not being bold enough, is essentially what Jesus was telling him here. And no, you know, if you think about it, why would Paul be a little bit timid in this particular situation? Again, as we talked about last week, when he went to Athens, he was going out into new territory. He was getting outside of his comfort zone. He was confronting paganism and Greek philosophy head on now. You know, not so much just reasoning in the synagogues. Now he is taking on paganism. We saw his speech that he gave at Athens, you know, where he talked about all the pagan gods and the unknown God, and he compared the message of Christ, which has to do with the resurrection of the body, in opposition to the pagan idea of the immortality of the soul. You know, and so Jesus is telling Paul here, look, I want you to be bold with this message. Don't be intimidated by, first of all, don't be intimidated by the Jews who oppose you, but don't be intimidated by all the pagan gods and the Greek philosophy and all this other kind of stuff. I want you to be bold with this message. So he says, verse 10, "For I am with you, and no one will attack you or hurt you, for I have many people in this city." And he continued there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. So, you know, this is a long time. Paul's here a year and a half in Corinth now, after getting thrown out of the synagogue, in the house of Jason, with the former ruler of the synagogue now as a Christian, and heading up the new church there in Corinth, and Paul staying there a year and a half, teaching. Now, verse 12. When Gallio, the proconsul of Achaia, when Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul. And this is sometime during that year and a half that he was teaching, and brought him to the judgment seat. You know, they're getting jealous. The church in Corinth now is growing by leaps and bounds. Not only does have some of the Jews become part of this new movement, including the former head Jew, the head ruler of the synagogue, but many, many Gentiles are joining with them as well. And they're jealous. The Jews are jealous. And so they, it says, with one accord, they rose up against Paul and brought him to the judgment seat, saying, "This fellow persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." And when Paul was about to open his mouth, he hadn't even begun to defend himself yet, Gallio said to the Jews, quote, "If it were a matter of wrongdoing or wicked crimes, O Jews, there would be reason why I should bear with you." You know, if Paul was stealing or, you know, pillaging or, you know, using violence or something like that, then I would, I'd be willing to hear what you have to say. But, he says, "But if it's a question of words and names and of your own law," that is the law of Moses, "look to it yourselves, for I do not want to be a judge of such matters." And he drove them from the judgment seat, So the Jews get this big riot going, and they drag Paul before the judgment seat, and the judge says, I'm not going to listen to this. Get out of here. So what happens? Then all the Greeks, that is the Greeks who the Jews had stirred up to get this riot going, all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue. Now, this is the new ruler of the synagogue. You remember back in verse 8, it says, Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his household. So he leaves the synagogue and joins with Paul. Well, apparently there's a new ruler of the synagogue, and this is probably the guy who instigated all the rioting. So it says, then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. But Gallio took no notice of these things. That is, he just didn't look, he didn't care. If you want to beat up the guy who's, creating all the problems here, it's okay with me. I'm just going to pretend I didn't see that. That's essentially what he's doing. Verse 18. So Paul remained a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria. Now, Syria is where he's from. That is, it's where Antioch is. Antioch was the church. The church in Antioch was Paul's missionary base. The church in Antioch is where Paul was ministering and preaching and teaching. It says that the Spirit or the breath of God said, separate Paul and Barnabas for the work that I have called them. And so the church in Antioch then laid hands on Paul and Barnabas and sent them out the first time to go out into Gentile territory and start preaching the gospel to the Gentiles. So it's the church in Antioch in Syria was Paul's home church. It's where he was sent from. And it's at the end of each of his missionary trips, it's where he returned to in order to give a report of all that had happened on his trip. So they're his sponsoring church. All right, so verse 18, it says, he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria. So he's headed home, but he doesn't go directly home because they would sail across from Macedonia to Asia Minor, which is today Turkey, and then usually they would travel by land or they would sail around Turkey, stopping in various ports around Turkey until they come around the southern side of Turkey and then go up into Syria or, up near Cyprus and then travel by land up into Antioch. So anyway, it says that he took leave of the brethren. He sailed for Syria. That's his destination. His ultimate destination was Syria. It says, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. So now when he leaves, he takes this man, Aquila, and his wife Priscilla, who no doubt were instruments in the founding of the church in Rome, but they had been expelled from Rome, if you remember correctly, when all the Jews were expelled from Rome. So now he takes them with him as well, because Corinth is not their home. They were just hanging out there while they were expelled from Rome, right? So he takes them with him, and it says he had his hair cut off at Cenchrea. Remember Cenchrea, we heard that before when we read Romans chapter 16, verse 1, where when Paul wrote his letter to Rome, he had it delivered by Phoebe, who was a deaconess of this church in Cenchrea. All right. And it says he had his hair cut off at Cenchrea because he had taken a vow. Now, this vow that Paul took is what's called the Nazarite vow. We'll talk more about that when we get a couple more chapters into the book of Acts, because the Nazarite vow involved a period of time in which you dedicated yourself especially to God. And part of the taking of the vow was to shave the head. And then you would devote yourself 100% to God, and you would abstain from many things that you normally could do, like from wine and things like that, until the completion of your vow. And then at the completion of your vow, you would have to go to the temple in Jerusalem and you would have to shave your head a second time. And the hair that you took off of your head represented the time from the beginning of your vow until the end of your vow, because it, you know, you start off with a bald head, your hair grows out, then you take the hair that grew out during your vow, and you offer that as part of your sacrifice along with an animal sacrifice at the temple at the completion of your vow. And we'll see that Paul actually did all that later. So this is the beginning of his vow here. And then he says, verse 19, and he came to Ephesus. Now, Ephesus is on his way back, going back to Antioch in Syria, back to his home church. But he stops at a at a port that's not far from Ephesus in Asia Minor. And he left them there. That is, Paul left Priscilla and Aquila at Ephesus, but he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. Now, no doubt he left Priscilla and Aquila at Ephesus because the Jews there were receptive to the message of the gospel, as we'll see. When they asked him to stay a longer time with them, that is, the Jews at the synagogue, he did not consent. And so that's why, obviously, he left Priscilla and Aquila, because they were Jews, they were Christians. So he left them there to continue to answer questions and so forth. But Paul didn't want to stay at Ephesus at this time and get involved with establishing a church, because he had something else he felt that he needed to do. And it tells us in the next verse. But he took leave of them, saying, quote, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem. Oh, Paul observed the Jewish feasts. Yes, he indeed did. So much so, and it was so important to him to go to Jerusalem to observe this particular feast, that he didn't even stay in Ephesus when the Jews in the synagogue were open to his message. He didn't even stay there. Instead, he left behind Priscilla and Aquila to stay there because Paul wanted to be in Jerusalem for the festival. But I will return to you again, God willing, and he sailed from Ephesus. All right. And when he had landed at Caesarea, now where's Caesarea? Caesarea is on the coast near, not far from Jerusalem. All right, so he's sailed down from Turkey, and now he's come to the coast as far as you can sail if you're going to Jerusalem. He lands at Caesarea, and then it says, and gone up and greeted the church, that is the church at Jerusalem. So if you're going to Jerusalem and you're sailing, you have to land at Caesarea. So that's what he did. It says he went up and greeted the church, and then he went down to Antioch. Now, what's interesting here is it says that he wanted to go because he says, I must by all means keep the coming feast in Jerusalem. And then when he gets there, it says he went up and greeted the church. Now, what does that imply? Well, what it implies is that the church in Jerusalem was the whole church in Jerusalem was observing the feasts, and that Paul wanted to observe this feast, and it was probably Passover. All right, Paul wanted to be in Jerusalem to observe the Passover with the Jewish church in Jerusalem. Isn't that pretty fascinating, right? All right, so what happens next? Verse 23. After he had spent some time there, he departed and went. Verse 22. And when he had landed at Caesarea and gone up to, and greeted the church, he went down to Antioch. Now, Antioch, again, is where he started from. That's his home church. So he went back, and as he did at the end of his first missionary journey with Barnabas, he went back and reported to the church all that he had accomplished on his missionary journey. All right, so this brings us, verse 22 brings us to the end of Paul's second missionary journey. Verse 23, we'll pick up next week. That is the beginning of Paul's third missionary journey, which ultimately, if you count, ultimately that's going to end up with Paul going back to Rome, being imprisoned, and having some other difficulties, which the book of Acts actually ends with that. All right, so we'll pick up his third missionary journey starting next week. All right, God bless you all, and it's been great talking to you today.